show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Hey, everybody. This is Mike Engle with the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Jeff and I are actually kind of taking this week off. We're just not used to having no Royals World Series coverage to provide here on the podcast. But we didn't want to leave you with nothing to listen to this week. So we went digging into our interview archives and we found an interview with Curt Nelson, the director of the Royals Hall of Fame. Back in March, he was kind enough to give us some of his time. We asked him for 15 minutes. He gave us 45. So we're very grateful for that. So what we've got ahead for you is about 20 minutes of a larger conversation talking about comparisons of the Royals in 85 to the 2015 World Championship team, some discussion of retired numbers and comparing, in this case, it was Alex Gordon to some of the greats, George Brett, Frank White, Dick Houser, who have their numbers retired, and then just kind of running down some of the best playoff memories involving the Royals, specifically comparing 1985 to 2015. So we're always grateful to talk to Curt Nelson. He is a treasure trove of information about the Royals. His job depends on that, so he does a very good job with the museum. So if you're out at the stadium next season, I would recommend stopping by the museum, checking out the exhibits, and if you get a chance to talk to Curt Nelson about baseball, do it. He's a great guy to chat with. So this will be the interview. I hope you enjoy it. We hope to include more of our chat with Curt in the future and possibly with some future projects. So if you like this, just let us know. Send us an email at kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com or send us a tweet on Twitter at @KCBaseballVault. And until next time, thank you for listening as always.
Well, you know, because of who Alex is and his preparation and his, you know, persistence and perseverance and everything that I think we can take for granted that his performance over the next 3 or 4 years is going to be, it's going to be good. He's going to produce, and we're willing that he doesn't suffer any serious injuries, which he had one last year. But so he's got a chance to, like you were saying, really put up numbers. I mean, when you look across, he's already in the top 10 in games played, at bats, runs, hits, doubles, home runs, RBIs, walks, total bases, extra base hits. I mean, you almost pick the positive offensive category, and he's already in the bottom half of the top 10. And like you said, 4 more years, he's probably going to move into the top part of the top 10, top 5. In almost all of those categories, that's going to put him in rarefied air. So, I mean, if his career keeps on the trajectory it is, and he's been, you know, all the years that he signed, and who knows, maybe even a little bit past that, if there's another contract mm-hmm. in the offing out there, you know, he could be right there at the top. So could he rank with the Mount Rushmore-ish of Royals history? I certainly think that there's a possibility for that. He's already building a case for that, and he's got, you know, another 4 or 5 years to be able to cement that case a little bit more. So yeah, I do think that there's a possibility that he's going to go down as, you know, one of the top, certainly top five. He has a chance to be one of the top five players in Royals history. We can all debate on position players, which ones are, you know, you have George and Frank, and I always think Amos Otis is way up on that category two because of what he could do, sort of an all-around game. Mm-hmm. In some ways reminiscent, they played different outfield positions, but in some ways reminiscent of Alex and the fact that he could do a little bit of everything. And both play great defense too, which is important. So I do think he can definitely be right up there. The one thing I always say, and this is a little off topic to that, but the one thing that I think is really interesting about Alex Gordon, and he's a four-time Gold Glove winner, and he should be five. Cespedes has Alex's fifth Gold Glove. We'll leave that argument there. But what I do think is interesting over the last couple of years is the development of this team as a defensive team and how we've been able to see how important that is. Intuitively, you know defense is important in baseball, but I don't think as Royals fans, we've necessarily completely understood how important defense can be. Now, the earlier championship era Royals teams that were very good defensively, especially in particular spots as well. This team all around the last couple of years has been so good defensively. And in some ways, the lead defensive player is the left fielder. Now, you wouldn't normally think that the left fielder is going to be the key defensive player or the one that's going to drive your overall defensive play as a team. And now they're all individually skilled. But in some ways, you know, as if there's a team leader that sort of set the tone for the defensive ability and the way we play defense and that sort of thing, it's been Alex. And that's a rare thing. You think center fielder or shortstop or something like, you know, the left fielder, I think he's been a key linchpin to our defense. And you don't normally think about that, but Alex is, you know, from left field, I think, coming in on the ball, especially, I don't think I've ever seen a player that can come in on the ball in left field any better than Alex Gordon. He's very good and has gotten better at going back. He's reckless, you know, as far as his body goes, willing to slam into the wall like he did in the ALCS game four in 2014 with that great play. And then also into the foul territory, he's done that several times, sliding across or in Chicago last year in April when he dove into the stands. I mean, these are the types of things that he'll do, and I do think he sort of sets the tone even as a left fielder for this tremendous Royals defense. I think that's sort of that's sort of geeky, but a little interesting that the left fielder could be sort of a linchpin on defense. I don't think that's a normal thing people would think about a baseball team.
That's usually where you stash some of the guys that you want to get in the lineup, but don't really want to put them at first base or DH, and they can kind of play left field. Billy Butler debuted as a left fielder. Just
he did indeed.
We all remember that. Yes,
not for very long, but he did. with all that considered, with Gordon, do you think he'll end up with a retired number?
Well, you know, there's no prescribed procedure for a retired number. So, I mean, it's hard to say. It's one of those things where you can build a case. And so the only thing that you can sort of look at is like, well, whose number is retired, right? So you look at them and you say, well, what did they bring to them? What was special about them? What made them worthy of that honor, which is, you know, the Hall of Fame is probably the biggest honor the organization can bestow upon someone. And I suppose there's one step higher would be not only a Hall of Famer, but a number retired Hall of Famer. And if you look, the 5, the 10, and the 20, they each have reasons. The stories are all a little bit different. The 10 is, you know, Dick Houser and bringing us our first world championship, and I love being able to say first. I can say that now, our first world championship, because there's more than one. But, and, you know, he did wonderful things and really was very successful for and really a transition time. It really transitioned to that original sort of Royals championship teams into the 84 and 85 versions that made the playoffs, and 81 team made the playoffs too, but the 84 and the 85 one make the playoffs and lead to a World Series of a slightly different team, you know, especially pitching staff. You know, the pitching staff was based on a whole bunch of young players that were almost, no, except for in the bullpen with Quiz, really none of those guys were around on the, you know, 76 to 80 sort of team. So he really bridged that gap and was important in being able to get those teams into the playoffs. And then of course, you know, he passes away tragically, you know, gets sick the next year and then passes away in 87. So that plays some role in because his is the story untold, right? So we knew that Dick could lead the Royals to championships. He could lead them to a World Series championship, and then he was gone. And so some of that play, some of his is what might have been, might be the late 80s have been different had Dick Houser lived. I will always believe that, especially the 87 team, I will always believe that Billy Gardner is a very good baseball man and had a tie back to the Royals from 1969, but he had been gone for a while, you know, with the Twins and other places. He hadn't been on the inside. And I, going back to that season, I'm old enough to remember the 87 season was a little frustrating. The fact that we were 1-2 games behind the Twins, 3 games behind the Royals, get back to 1. We never could quite get there. And I always felt that if Dick Houser had been the manager of that team, we would have won in 87. And I also feel in some ways that had we gone to John Woffen earlier that season as manager, we might have been able to get a second half kick to be able to get over the Twins. And I don't mean to be disparaging to Billy Gardner at all when I say that. I just think that the continuity might have been a little bit different had that been, but there were reasons for that and everything. But I always think that what 87 might have been, but that goes into Dick's story. And Frank White's story is, you know, the Royals Academy guy, the hometown guy who fights through. And I always think Frank's story is interesting because he becomes beloved in Kansas City and as a guy that grew up in Kansas City. But when his career started with the Royals, people didn't really like the fact that he was taking over for the fan favorite. Like, it wasn't an easy transition into becoming a starter for Frank. He wasn't necessarily loved right at the beginning that was because he was taking over for Cookie Rojas, who had been such a fan favorite and an important part of the veteran presence on that early Royals team to help them become champions, and then would go on and win the 8 Gold Gloves. Should have been 9.
Yep.
Harold Reynolds once when and he said he told me the one time I was at MLB Network the one time and I joked with him about it. I told him I'm just joking with you. Please don't take me to. And he's like, dude, I didn't vote for it. You know, it was sort of defensive. I think he's heard that a lot. And he has the utmost respect for Frank White. But, you know, the focus on Frank is on defense. But, you know, in some respects, like Ozzie Smith and the fact that it's focused on defense, but that gets short shrift to his development, especially at the major league level on offense. You know, Frank was important on the 85 team and those championship teams. And he had big home runs. He was the ALCS MVP in 80, had the big home run in game 3 of the 1985 World Series. That was really a key to help us win that game and get that turned around. So, you know, Frank came through on offense and became an important offensive player. And so you can see where his retired number comes from. And then, you know, George, one of the greatest,
right.
Not only greatest Royals of all time, but the, you know, one of the greatest players of his generation. That one's a clear number retirement. So you can sort of, you see the lines for what number retiring and you think about that. So when you look at Alex and you say, well, he's, and we're only partway through his story already. 3 All-Star games already, 5, 4 Gold Gloves. See, I said 5. I think it should be 5, but it's 4 Gold Gloves. You know, and not least of which the story of being a first-round draft pick, can't-miss prospect, go back down, come back at a different position, the perseverance to do that, great part of that story. And now he's been on two straight American League pennant winning teams and a key part of both of them, a World Series champion with the key moment, I would say, in the World Series championship for the Royals, game one, down a run against the Mets closer at Kauffman Stadium, hits that home run. I think there's a lot of key moments in the World Series, you know, Hosmer's mad dash to home in game five and all the things that happened in those two games in New York, and Johnny Cueto's performance in game two. But, you know, I think the signature point, the sort of the pivot point, is Alex's home run in the ninth inning there. So he's got all of that there, and he's still building a case. I mean, that's a whole story right there, right? And yeah. The story isn't even over yet.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things we wanted to talk about. We've kind of talked about Gordon's legacy as a whole, you know, as a player with the organization, but this obviously there was a dark period of Royals baseball, but there's still a lot of really iconic moments that have happened for this team and this organization. I mean, between the pine tar incident with George Brett that they always seem to show, and just general baseball stuff, and then George Brett's home run off Goose Gossage in game three of the ADCLs, right, to finally break through and get to the World Series after so many times losing to the Yankees. So if you were to kind of rank that, it's a very tough exercise, I know, but just to kind of put some perspective on it from someone who is, you know, so well averse in the Royals history, where would you rank that Gordon moment from with that ninth inning home run compared to all the other great things that have happened?
Well, you know, when you think about World Series championships, the two World Series championships, and you try to figure out, okay, what are the key moments? Well, 1985 is, the key moment. Like, so the pivot moment in that one comes later. It comes in game six, right? Mm-hmm. At least that would be my bone of contention, would be it comes in game six, and it comes from a non-star player. You know, what Dick Houser would lovingly and with respect call his spare parts. And that's another thing that Dick Houser did in that is Dick Houser, especially in that game six, used every card he had, right? And he kept them because he allowed Charlie Liebrandt to hit in a pivotal position in that game earlier when there's no score in that game. And he makes an out, and the Royals don't score. And then Brian Harper gets that hit, and the Cardinals take the lead, which sets Dick Houser up for, why in the world didn't you pinch hit in that situation? Why didn't you pinch hit for Charlie Liebrandt in that run-scoring situation when you could have won the game? He had all those things, and he was willing to take that, right? And he certainly would have got it, and Brian would have deserved it probably. You know, sometimes you play – a hunch, right? And it didn't work in that case. So he comes back later on in the ninth inning, and he has to wade through a couple of guys. He has Orta, and he's got Dane Orge there to use, right? And he used them, and they both came through. Now George Orta comes through in a slightly different way, and sure, we all know that story. I'm always mm-hmm. the chapter and verse on that story is it's a key call. You never know what was going to happen, but we do know that had the right call been made, that we still don't know what was going to happen, right? But my contention on that one is there's a lot of people that say that if the correct call is made there, they know what's going to happen. The Cardinals are going to win the World Series. Well, that's not true. Because mm-hmm. there was the first out of the inning, right? And that would have mm-hmm. been the first out of the inning, or the first hitter of the inning.
And Orton never even scored.
But Dick Houser, he was the only out recorded.
So he had all those spare parts. So you think that key moment that time is Dane Orge getting the hit. In 2015, what's the key moment, right? So you try to think 85. So you think about the wins. I think of Frank White's home run in game three as a key moment, but we were actually already leading at that point. So I think it was, that was more of a, that really put the, you know, Saints was on the mound and it's like, okay, after that home run, we're going to win this game. We're going to win this game. And then it's sort of a team effort in the other game, and Danny Jackson winning a key game five again, two times in two series in a row. And then we come home and the key pivot point is the Dean Orge hit in the ninth inning that, that wins the game. And then nobody, there's not a whole lot to remember from game seven in that particular one, except for the fact that the Daryl Motley home run is the foul home run and then the fair home run and the whole 9 yards on that. But there's not a whole lot to remember from game seven other than happy, happy, joy, joy. It was tremendous, you know, 11, a little bit like this year, except it was much shorter.
It took a lot longer.
The series was over before it was over. But so now we go to 2015. What are the key points? Well, game one is obviously Alex Gordon's home run. You think later on, you know, it set up several situations where we had opportunities to win. The Mets had opportunities to score runs too. And you get into that, that 14th inning and we had the bases loaded and you felt pretty confident that Eric was going to get something done. We, an out was going to win the game. And that's exactly what happened. So the key moment to me, and I don't think anybody would disagree, is Alex's home run. Eric's sacrifice fly wins the game, and but Alex's home run is the key moment in that. Johnny Cueto was the key moment in game two, and game four had some key moments. One of them, obviously, by Daniel Murphy, made a key moment for us. But the relentlessness of what we were doing at that time is sort of the story of game four. You know, give us an opening and we'll rip through it. And we were sort of on that path and they gave us an opening and we came flying right through it. And then game five, you have the two key moments in that one, obviously are Eric's mad dash home. And then Christian Colon, another sort of Dane Orge-ish story. Although one was an older player and one's a younger player, but not often used. Not a whole lot of at bat comes through with the winning hit. So I still go back that Alex Gordon's home run is the pivot point of the entire World Series. That's sort of retrospective because we know how it ended. So now you can look back and say, okay, well, the chart was the trip. We charted the course.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com. And that was Sinfonia in A Major by Sam Martini. It's noted that the third vicar of Dunshire would play that every night before delivering sermons. It's a fine piece of music. It's 10 past the hour here on Vault Public Radio. We wanted to remind you, dear listener, that this week is Pledge Week at the Vault. Your support is vital, and giving to Vault Public Radio is one way to help support your community. And speaking of community, you won't find a better friendly community than the staff at Kelly's Westport Inn. Like public radio, Kelly's is a staple of the community, a standard, an icon, a Kansas City tradition. Fine patrons like yourself have been supporting Kelly's Westport Inn since 1947, when, I'd note, that Randall Kelly poured his first pint. Contribute to Vault Public Radio today, you can get an official VPR tote bag, or you could stop by Kelly's for an affordable pint, the best pizza in town, and a few games of Papa Shot.
We're grateful for your support at VPR and for your support at Kelly's Westport Inn. Enjoy the tradition. And now, 4 hours of Best of the Baroque Period, followed by the Amstein Theater's And the Horse You Rode In On, hosted by Joseph Guevara Amherst.